It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up tonight at 6 here on the Ideas Network, 1A Plus reviews the first week of COP26. Finds some perspective on a new grim milestone for COVID-19 and explains why Ethiopia is now approaching a tipping point. Join Jen White for the global edition of 1A's Friday News Roundup tonight starting at 6 on the Ideas Network. Now, today is the fifth day in the end of the first week in the homicide trial of Illinois teenager Kyle Rittenhouse. Last year, Rittenhouse traveled from Antioch to Kenosha during protests following Jacob Blake's shooting by police. He's charged with killing two people and injuring a third. We're going to get the latest on the trial itself and then take a look a little wider about some of the likely ramifications of the jury's ultimate decision. And we want to hear from you on this at 1-800-642-1234. Have you been following the trial this week? And if so, what stood out to you? If you haven't been following the trial, what would you like to have updated or clarified? Have you ever served on a jury in a homicide case? And what would that experience have been like? You can call us 1-800-642-1234. You can drop us a line on our Ideas Network Facebook page or email us ideas@WPR.org. Let's begin by bringing in Corinne Hess, WPR reporter from Milwaukee in southeast Wisconsin. She's been covering the trial for WPR and NPR. Corey, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
As the trial began this week, could you take us back to the opening arguments of the prosecution and the defense?
Yes, when it began, both sides were just laying out what they're going to be presenting over these next 2 weeks. And really what it is the prosecution is trying to characterize Kyle Rittenhouse as this violent, trigger-happy vigilante who came to Kenosha and killed Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber and wounded Gage Grosskreutz. And the defense is, presenting this same young man as a concerned citizen who came to Kenosha to try to protect a community after two nights of violent protests.
And as the case got underway, as we heard from Brady Carlson in the news, there has been some video evidence presented and there has been some testimony this week. Corey, what stood out to you?
Like you just mentioned, the video has really been the star of the trial this week. Jurors have been watching these videos almost endlessly. And they're showing Mr. Rittenhouse sort of throughout this chaotic night of August 25th, 2020. And at times they're really hard to watch. I mean, the videos show the shooting and death of Joseph Rosenbaum. And the prosecution is just trying to show really methodically how Kyle Rittenhouse started out, just sort of walking the streets, and then the night ended in death. And the defense is just kind of trying to hammer home in their cross-examination how he allegedly had to shoot these men because it was self-defense. But just these videos are being shown over and over.
As the week began, we had a selection of 20 jurors, which will, as I understand it, be boiled down to 12, ultimately, who will decide the fate of Kyle Rittenhouse. But we have lost a couple of jurors in the last couple of days. Corey Hess, what can you tell us about that?
Yes. So yesterday morning, one of the jurors was dismissed after telling an off-color joke about Jacob Blake. Jacob Blake, of course, is the man who was shot by Kenosha police 7 times and is now paralyzed. So this man was telling a joke to another law enforcement official there about that, and he was dismissed. And then this morning, a juror was she asked to leave. She's pregnant, and she was saying that she was having some issues, so she went home. When all of this started, the jury was sat in just one day, which is pretty unusual. And there's 8 alternates, and so that seemed like a lot, but, 2 are already gone, so maybe it wasn't too many.
And Corey, you've been covering this trial for NPR as well as Wisconsin Public Radio, and what is the national spotlight here? Why is NPR focusing on this case?
Well, I think the nation is focusing on this case because of just how much video there was with both the Jacob Blake shooting and then the Kyle Rittenhouse shootings. All of this was captured on amateur cell phone video by the protesters and journalists that were there that night, and all of that was put on social media. So much of this has been seen, and so many people think that they know so much already about this case and have made their minds up. Also, this case became political. Both President Biden and then President Trump were campaigning at the time and weighed in on this. Well, especially President Trump did, and then Joe Biden also talked about it. Both visited Kenosha. So this really had a whole national spin to it last year. And what's interesting is that a lot of people are talking about it nationally, but in Kenosha, you know, nobody's coming to the courthouse during the day to watch this. And there's nobody outside protesting or anything that was really anticipated before the trial. So it feels like in Kenosha, a lot of people want to put this chapter behind them and just move on from it.
Interesting. And Corey, how long is this case expected to go on? What are you expecting to come next week?
Well, on Monday, Gage Grosskreutz, which is, again, the man who was shot and wounded by Kyle Rittenhouse, will testify. And the prosecution has said that they're planning to wrap up on Tuesday. And then the court has said that they're anticipating a little over 2 weeks. So that could put us at maybe, you know, November 16th, 17th. But, you know, it's anybody's guess, really.
Well, and then how long the jury deliberations may go on.
Exactly.
Yeah. Corey, thank you so much for the latest this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Corinne Hess covering Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin for us, and she's been covering the Rittenhouse trial for Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio. Now let's bring in Cecilia Klingel, an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on topics including criminal law and sentencing. Cecilia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to expand beyond the Rittenhouse trial, but to start, what have been some of your initial takeaways from what's happened in the courtroom this week?
Well, to the degree I've been able to follow the details, I think mostly what is of interest is how much this is really capturing people's minds. To some degree, the story of police violence, protests against it, protection of community, is this story sadly is becoming an old one. And yet we're still seeing a fascination by the public and an engagement and a polarization on how this case ought to play out.
I want to go to the phones here because there is a question. Lou in Ashland joins us. Lou, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, he's not even from the city. He's not from the state. He is an outsider. He has no defense for self-defense of his city. It is not his place. The adults in his life have failed him greatly. As children grow, they expect guidance, sound guidance, from their adults in their life, and his parents failed.
Lou, thank you. And so as we look at what's going on in the courtroom, I'm just, Cecilia, is self-defense, to what degree and in the law do we see self-defense if you're walking into, and knowingly, admittedly walking into what could be harm's way?
So much will depend on the very specific factual context, but the law is very narrowly focused here. In contexts like this, where people are in a public space and they use force against another person, the law is going to focus really narrowly on the interaction that immediately precedes that use of force, asking whether the person using force reasonably believes him or herself to be in danger, and then whether that person reasonably used proportional force in response.
UW-Madison quoted you responding to the trial with a couple of things I wanted to unpack here. First, you said, we want the jury to be a check on the power of the state and to enforce community norms. So when the law requires that force is used reasonably, we want our community to decide what it is that is or isn't reasonable. So with that last part, the idea of a group of normal folks agreeing what is reasonable use of force, How do you think that would apply in the Rittenhouse case, Cecilia?
Well, this is what juries do, right? Juries sort out for us competing facts, but they also exercise their moral judgment around what we as a community think is appropriate when the law ties the legality of our behavior to reasonable action. So in this case, as I said, really the fundamental question is whether the defendant believed himself to be in danger of death or great bodily harm, and whether in using lethal force himself, he was using the force that was appropriate under the circumstances. And reasonableness is a question about our values and our judgment. And so we ask ordinary people from the county where the crime was committed, allegedly, and where the trial is being held to exercise their judgment about whether his behavior was reasonable under the circumstances. And the real challenge here is that we are living at a time and in a climate where people are very deeply divided on the reasonableness of behavior like that is being discussed in the courtroom today.
The reasonableness of the behavior of Kyle Rittenhouse on trial in Kenosha. Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on topics including criminal law and sentencing. We want to hear about what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Do you believe in the ability of juries to form consensus on a community norm? Do you believe in the credibility of a verdict reached by a jury, and what ramifications might that verdict have reverberating across Wisconsin? 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation with Cecilia Klingel about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial continues next on Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is the Ideas Network. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our conversation with Cecilia Klingel, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and we're taking a look at the use of force, the function of juries, in this week's homicide trial of Illinois teenager Kyle Rittenhouse. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234, where Troy is standing by in Muskego. Troy, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hello.
Hey, what do you think?
Yes. So my thing is, you know, whole take on this is, you know, this is a prime example of white privilege to me. You know, you got somebody, you know, you got the day that you would see a black parent say, hey, get this full assault rifle, go to another state and walk around with it. And when they have to talk to their kids about putting their hands on the steering wheel so they don't get shot, right? So then you get a white kid that walks around in a crowd with a full assault rifle, walks right past the SWAT team, and right away he's assumed to be a good guy when he just murdered somebody. And to me, it's just a prime example of that. You know, you would never see that you know, this would never even, if that was a black child, he would have probably got shot walking 5 feet, in that crowd with a rifle.
It sounds like it goes to the heart of reasonableness, which our guest, Cecilia Klingel, says is the charge that the jury is charged with having to find and decide. So, Cecilia, when it comes to deciding reasonableness at this jury, are there ramifications that will expand beyond whatever verdict they decide? Will we be redefining what self-defense may look like in Wisconsin, or setting some standard going forward?
That's a really great question, and both of the last two callers really want to zoom out to the larger context in which the defendant used force that night. And that makes sense, because we're all interested as parents and as citizens in the way people are behaving in our communities. But when we talk about reasonableness in the context of self-defense and what the jury is going to be asked to decide, they're not asked to decide whether it was reasonable for the defendant to be in Kenosha that night, or whether it was reasonable for his parents to support his behavior. They're only going to be asked if he was reasonable at the moment he used force in assessing that he was at that moment in danger of death or great bodily harm, and that using lethal force was appropriate under those circumstances in order to protect himself. That's all the jury gets to decide. They don't get to weigh in on these larger questions, important though they may be.
And yet, does that decision from the jury reverberate throughout Wisconsin in defining what self-defense may look like going forward?
this certainly will give us one more factual context, a story in which we can decide that force was found by a particular jury to be appropriate or not appropriate under the circumstances, reasonable or not. But generally, in cases of self-defense, we're looking at very unique factual circumstances. And quite frankly, even in the Rittenhouse case, the jury is going to be making several determinations about reasonableness for every single criminal count in which the defendant is raising a self-defense claim. The jury has to look at the particular interactions that preceded the use of force individually, person by person, use of force by use of force, and make a separate decision, which makes, I think, the broader impact of this decision more limited.
Let's go to Linda in Black Earth. Linda, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Yes, hi. I'm so upset I can hardly speak. I don't think I heard anybody say anything at all about the fact that this was a 17-year-old underage person coming from out of state with an AK-15 assault-type rifle that should only be allowed to be used in wars. Is nobody talking about the fact that he was a minor? Isn't it against the law for a 17-year-old to carry a weapon?
It's not charged with that, as far as I understand, Cecilia.
Right. I mean, I think that you raise a whole bunch of really important questions, but that are outside the scope of what the jury is being asked to do. So one issue is weapons laws. What are the laws about who can possess what kinds of weapons? The other is his age. And I think it's important for us to note here that Wisconsin is one of the few states in the country where once you turn 17, you are treated as an adult for criminal charging purposes, even though you can still be considered a child victim for some kinds of crimes. So we have a defendant here who at 17, any behavior that occurs is going to be charged as adult criminal behavior. And that is unique to Wisconsin law.
Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on topics including criminal law and sentencing. Our guest as we take a look at the first week of the trial for Kyle Rittenhouse and what that means for all of us. And one of the themes of today's show seems to be the polarization of us, just us, our communities. And I wonder from your perspective, Cecilia, how you think that's changed, if at all, the work of juries?
In some ways, in an ideal circumstances, this gives juries the best opportunity to come together as representatives of our communities with very different ideas and to really hash out what it is that we think should define what reasonable behavior looks like. Again, that's ideal. We won't know what happens in that jury room. Jury deliberations are private. We don't get to hear or see what's going on in that space. It might be democracy at its best. It might, though, be a really fraught conversation, depending on how much common ground people are able to find.
As Corey Hess reports at WPR.org, there is one misdemeanor count charged against Kyle Rittenhouse for possession of a dangerous weapon by a minor. But that is just a charge at this time, and we'll see what happens going forward. And with that in mind, Cecilia, I'd look for some tips from you about how to improve our trial-following literacy. How can, and as you mentioned, the scope of the jury is going to be pretty specific and at large. As we've heard from the callers, it wants to be pretty broad. How can we watch this trial going forward smartly?
That's a great question. I think that coverage like this that focuses on the difference between community concerns and community conversations over broad issues like gun laws and protests and the involvement of minors in activities of this sort. Those are great conversations for us to be having in our communities. And it is also important for us to understand the divide between those considerations and the more narrow and focused considerations that are going on in the courtroom this week. People are likely to be dissatisfied if they don't understand the work that's really happening, which is trying to decide whether that jury is persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant here actually committed each of the crimes with which he is charged.
So what will you be watching most closely as this Rittenhouse trial continues into the next week and begins to look towards wrapping up?
I'm, I guess, most interested in the outcome of the case. I'm interested in seeing how the jury sorts through the competing charges in which self-defense has been raised to see if there's a pattern and consistency in the way that they're applying the law across those different counts.
And one of the things that has come up in this case so far is the judge saying that those that were killed or injured by Kyle Rittenhouse could not be considered victims. How common is that in a criminal case like this, Cecilia?
So I don't have empirical data to tell me how many judges have that as a courtroom rule. My understanding is that this judge applies that consistently across cases, and it's certainly not an uncommon position for judges to take, that until we have sorted the facts out and a jury has decided whether or not a crime has been committed, that in a legal way of speaking, we don't yet know whether there are victims of crimes, because we don't know if there is a crime. That, of course, isn't the way that ordinary people talk about these things, but in courtrooms, it's not that unusual.
And that will be for the jury to decide, correct?
Yes, indeed.
Hey, Cecilia, thank you so much for your knowledge this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on topics including criminal law and sentencing. And we talked with her today about her reactions to the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and got some of your thoughts as well about how what this means at large. I want to remind you, coming up Monday on Central Time, vaccination mandates in the workplace. What are your rights when it comes to your safety and the safety of others? Also, more national recognition for the quality of the city life in Milwaukee and the science of seasonal smells. That's all Monday afternoon starting at 3 here on the Ideas Network. And coming up after the news, Wisconsin's public schools are facing threats both old and new while striving towards some semblance of a return to normalcy for their students. So we'll go around Wisconsin to find out how our schools are combating cyber attacks, reinforcing physical safety, and responding to recall efforts for school board members with implications that stretch far beyond any school district's boundaries. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. Coming up later this hour, Dori Greenspan returns as our guest chef for Food Friday with 150 new signature recipes that promise to be sweet, salty, and simple. So stay tuned. First, Wisconsin schools are facing threats both old and new. Beloit Public Schools were closed today, while the Janesville School District last week said that it has been the target of yet another ransomware attack. Now, these cyber attacks on schools have been on the rise in the past few years. Schools are a target because of their access to useful data like addresses and social security numbers, among other reasons like aging technology. We're talking about the recent cyber attacks on Janesville School District and the threats against schools more generally. And we want to hear from you this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234. Has your school district ever been the subject of a ransomware attack? What about yourself? What happened? What do you think can be done to boost school cybersecurity? What do you think schools get right, and what do they get wrong? Our phone number to call in is 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Madeline Fox is the K-12 education reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Maddie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
Yeah, before we get to what happened with the Janesville School District last week, let's start with what's happening today with the Beloit Public Schools. What do we know?
So what we know is that school was canceled today because there is a planned protest, actually right about now at 3 p.m. outside of the school board building. My understanding is that it's being organized by the Wisconsin chapter of the Proud Boys, which is an organization that defines itself as supporting free speech and patriotism, but it is actually listed as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And that protest is a response to an incident that happened in a classroom in Beloit last week. And we have kind of mixed reports about what happened in that classroom, but this student and his parents say that the teacher taped his mask to his face after he wouldn't wear it. the teacher says something different, some students in the classroom say something different as well, and the Beloit Police Department investigated, and they say that there's no evidence that any crime was committed.
Do we know what led to the decision to close the schools today and what that mean going forward yet, Maddie?
I think it was an abundance of caution. In the Proud Boys do have a reputation of being, you know, at best a little in your face and at worst a little bit violent. And so I think it was just a concern that they just, that the school district just didn't want to potentially expose any teachers or students to that.
Keeping an eye on what's happening in Beloit today, what's not happening with their public schools closed. And now looking at the latest story from the Janesville School District, which announced a ransomware attack early last week. What do we know about what happened, Madeline?
We know a little bit and not a lot, which is kind of the way that things go with ransomware attacks and cyber attacks generally. It can take a while to sort of trace exactly what happened and how. But what we do know is that the school district said that it was hit with something that looks like ransomware over the weekend of October 24th. And that locked the district out of its network and its printers. And then their IT workers found some irregularities in their system's code. And the end result was that it really brought a lot of things to a halt for a solid chunk of last week. And that is actually still having some effect. You know, for example, students were supposed to get their final first quarter grades this week, but teachers were having trouble getting into the online portal to post them. And so those are now delayed.
And as you write in your story at WPR.org, Madeline, is this is not the first time that Janesville schools have faced an attack like this. I believe it was 2018 where something similar happened to their IT.
So actually that was Kenosha. That was
Kenosha.
Unified School District. Yes. But this isn't the first time we've seen this in Wisconsin, for sure.
In fact, how many times have we seen this across the state? Do we have a count of how many school districts and how many attacks?
That's kind of hard to say. So there's specifically ransomware. These are the two that I know of. We did see a lot of cyber events, especially last year when a lot of schools were online where, schools would describe them as hackers, but it's stuff like people got access to a school Zoom room that weren't supposed to have access and dropped in and did some interesting things, or, you know, things have been sent over school email systems that really should not have been sent. So it does kind of depend on how you define these events. They can be anything from phishing attacks to students using email for things that they shouldn't to these actual ransomware attacks.
Madeline Fox, our K-12 education reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. And Madeline, what is it that makes schools such a sweet target for these cyber attacks? What is it about what they have and how they can cyber thieves can access it?
Oh my gosh. So there's a few things that make schools pretty vulnerable. One of them is that they actually use technology a lot. We definitely saw that last school year and the school year before when schools were doing more of their learning online because of the pandemic. But even before that, you know, schools use computers, use their systems as a companion to teaching in terms of stuff like posting assignments, posting grades. They do online discussions for some classes. And then there's stuff that a lot of big employers do, you know, stuff like employee HR. Here at Wisconsin Public Radio, for example, you know, we enroll in our insurance online, and so do school districts in many ways. So there's a lot of use of technology in these school districts. And they are, in many cases, you know, one of the biggest, if not the biggest employer in their area. And so that's a lot of technology that they're using. And it's also a lot of people who have access to that technology. So one of the things that makes them really, really vulnerable is that they have a lot of devices and a lot of people using them, which means that, you know, if you only need one person to have a really insecure password or to fall for a phishing email, that's the odds are pretty good that that could happen.
Well, one thing you and I have in common are email addresses that end at WPR.org, and we've all received emails like those that are highly suspicious and dubious. But what do we know about what schools are doing in response to the increased threat of these cyber attacks, Madeline?
Yeah, well, like at our own organization, there's a fair bit of testing and trying to make sure that people, you know, see phishing emails and, you know, they'll send fake phishing emails and say like, oops, you fell for this. Here's how to not do this when it's a real threat. But we also see one of the things that school districts are stressing is phasing out old technology. Actually, in Kenosha's case, this was something that their technology officers talked to me about a lot, because when computers get old, when tablets get old, when printers get old, they can't necessarily update to the latest security update to different patches in the system. And so that means that, like, if somebody wants to break into a system, they can often get in through this older technology because it just can't, it doesn't have the same capacity to keep bad actors out.
Scott from Menominee called but couldn't stay on the line, was talking about how old systems are in the Menominee School District, and he has tough times just getting through the phone. As you mentioned, does old technology, does that make us more vulnerable?
It absolutely does, yes, because it just, and it's hard, too, for, you know, teachers who see how stressed their budgets sometimes get to see, you know, getting rid of computers that still work perfectly well or tablets that still work perfectly well. But the thing is, you know, this technology, once it can't get the security updates, once it can't update its, like, its virus scanning software or different patches that that manufacturers will often push through as they find vulnerabilities in their system, once it can't get those updates, it's a really vulnerable area.
Madeline Fox, there's a great comment attached to your article at WPR.org about this story in Janesville, which relays the experience of IT professionals. And they say, the comment reads, IT has to understand so many complex technologies, interoperability, security, infrastructure, coding language. And the expectation is that you have to learn them fast and constantly update your knowledge. And the cloud technologies and open source tech move so fast that you're always coming from behind. And by the time you learn it, you have to relearn. And so that can add an added stress on IT departments, and when they're on call and have to fix things that break, that management may not understand how IT is having to deal with everything that's coming their way in a now, largely remote workplace.
Right. Well, and I was just going to say, on top of all that information that these IT professionals have to work on, they also have to translate it to staff that has very different expertises, right? I mean, people who are hired in some cases because they're really good with kids, which doesn't necessarily mean that they have a really nuanced understanding of internet security.
I was thinking of people like us, Madeline.
Yes, also people like us.
Madeline Fox is the K-12 education reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, and we'd like to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think of cybersecurity at your school? And as we move on to the school board elections and the recalls for the school boards, what do you think about those? 1-800-642-1234. Conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with WPR K-12 education reporter Madeline Fox. Took a look at what is not happening in Beloit today, the recent news out of the cyber attack or in the Janesville schools, and now on to some of the school board recall efforts that we're seeing across the state. Wisconsin has seen recall efforts in 16 school districts over the past 2 years. Most recently, the recall election of the Mequon-Thiensville School Board, and our guest Madeline Fox with the latest on that. What do we know about what took place on Tuesday night at the polls in the Mequon-Thiensville School Board recall race, Maddie?
So in short, the recall failed. You know, Mequon-Thiensville was significant because it was the only school board recall effort to actually gather enough signatures to make it to the ballot in the last couple of years. Even as you said, we saw 16 efforts. This was the only one that made it as far as the ballot. We've got two that are still gathering signatures and could be on a later ballot, but for now it was just this one. And it did fail. And the reason that that's, I think, particularly significant is, I mean, it is hard to recall elected officials, but this is an off-cycle election, right? There's not a president on the ballot, there's not a governor on the ballot, turnout tends to be pretty low. And so given that this was a recall effort, you might have expected more people who were motivated to turn out to be those folks in support of the recall, because we know people who are unhappy with the status quo tend to vote. But in fact, the four board members who were up for recall all retained their seats at about a 58% to 42% split, which is a pretty commanding victory by the standards of election.
So what were the issues in play in this recall effort?
That is a great question. So, like a lot of recall efforts that we have seen, some of this does trace back to debates over whether and how schools should open in the pandemic, you know, whether that's virtual learning, and then it later became more of an issue of masks, which we saw After the governor's mask order expired last spring, we saw more school boards having to take up that issue of how they would protect against COVID. And that also, you know, lit up some tensions in districts. But what this particular recall effort ended up coalescing around was the people who were pushing the recall say that there's been an academic decline in the McOwen-Thiensville School District. It has consistently been one of the highest achieving school districts in the state. It actually, we get these report cards from the Department of Public Instruction every year, and we did not get them last year because of COVID. They weren't running the same kind of tests and information, so we didn't get them. But the most recent report card that they did have showed that McOwen-Thiensville still really exceeds expectations across the board, but there are some parents who were concerned that there had been an academic decline, and they particularly tied that to the way that race and equity is taught in that school district, what folks around the country are calling critical race theory.
And you spoke with the folks who, the organization Recall MTSD, behind the push for school board members to be recalled in McOwen-Thiensville School District. What have they said to you following Tuesday's results?
Well, they are regrouping and they are not done. They've actually rebranded to Restore MTSD. So I would imagine that we will see, you know, the election was pretty recent, but I would imagine that we will see, as those school board seats start to come up for election, which school board elections or seats are 3-year terms, generally speaking, and they're staggered. So usually a whole board is not up for election at the same time, which means that we also tend to get a new election about every 1 or 2 years in every district. So I would imagine that we will see some electoral challenges, which might be slightly different, right? Because recalls, again, don't tend to get quite the same amount of turnout as a typical election. And they're not always as popular as a straight election. So I think that we will see some of these issues certainly come up again in MTSD.
Madeline Fox is WPR's K-12 education reporter joining us this afternoon. And Madeline, our school board elections are supposed to be nonpartisan in Wisconsin, much like our state Supreme Court races are. But we've seen the politicization of our state Supreme Court races, and some are now expressing concerns about how school boards have been politicized. What did they have to relay to you?
Yes. So I think that that's actually such a significant point, the idea that school boards are being politicized, because the thing about school board elections is they are usually relatively nonpartisan, right? People don't register with a party. They don't tend to campaign with a party. But as we know from the Supreme Court, you know, politics can still creep into nonpartisan elections. What people are definitely more concerned about, because it would be particularly more unusual, is the politicization of school boards themselves. And so there is definitely a concern that we might see, you know, a lot of political pressure on school boards, that we might start seeing more partisan politics, especially as we're seeing this push nationally from organizations like the Heritage Foundation, like American Majorities, conservative organizations, this push for conservatives to sort of take over school boards and push concerns about, again, the teaching of race and equity, and again, you know, COVID-19 precautions. There is a concern that that will start showing up at the school board level. And that, you know, worries people on a couple fronts, because they're worried that their kids are going to get caught in these partisan political battles, because that is a school board's job, is really to shape and support kids' education. And so you don't tend to want that to be overly political. I think the other concern that I have heard is that as we see more of these partisan politics come to play in local elections, it might change the kind of people who even want to serve on these boards. You know, we've seen some resignations already in response to these recalls, in response to the very nasty school board meetings that I'm sure you've seen some videos of. And we've seen some superintendents leave as well. And so there's a concern that as politics come into play more, and as these really vitriolic issues come into play more, it's going to just potentially affect, you know, the leadership, the institutional knowledge, and the actual results that we will have from schools and school boards.
Madeline Fox, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Homicides are up in large cities across the nation, but Milwaukee's experiencing unprecedented numbers of violent crimes right now. Police say the crimes are being committed by younger people, and homicides are likely connected to the city's car thefts and reckless driving increases. Corrine Hess has more.
Last month, a 47-year-old Oshkosh woman tried to stop four teenagers from stealing a car at a Holiday Inn Express just outside Milwaukee and Wauwatosa. The woman was killed when one of the boys got into her car, pushed her out, and ran over her several times. The criminal complaint contained horrific details that led to a 13-year-old boy being charged as an adult. He faces six felony charges and up to 115 years in prison if convicted. The case is extreme, but it's one of the many violent crimes in Milwaukee County where young people are involved. Nick Desiato is the chief of staff at the Milwaukee Police Department. He says teens have easy access to guns, and younger people are stealing cars and driving recklessly, which is all connected.
And while those may seem like a very distinct category, a reckless driver who strikes another vehicle and kills somebody is still a form of a homicide or the contributing factor for somebody else's death.
At a small business hub in Milwaukee's Sherman Park community, activist Vaughn Mays says when he was a kid, he was committing crimes too, but now the stakes are much higher. At 15, he was doing what he called block banging. Now 34, he says it's still happening, but today kids as young as 12 are using guns instead of fists and posting the violence on social media to gain notoriety.
It's like reality TV on steroids.
One video posted on Facebook Live and obtained by WPR depicts three young women dancing and laughing while pointing a semi-automatic weapon at the screen. Sometimes the videos show teens or young people in stolen vehicles driving recklessly through crowded city streets. Mays believes young people have a live fast, die young attitude, which has made everything more dangerous in the city. But that doesn't mean they aren't still kids, many without much family support.
A lot of these kids, when you talk to them, like when they in these cars and they got these guns, they like the most tough person ever. But if you catch them outside of that, they not like that at all. They very scared, frail, fragile, sensitive.
Milwaukee police officials don't dispute Mays's claims. Homicides are up about 32% in large cities across the nation, but Desiato says no city has been hit harder than Milwaukee, which has seen an increase three times the national average. There were 190 homicides in Milwaukee last year, the most on record. Through last week, the city was on pace to pass that number. Today's version of block banging can't be blamed entirely for that increase. Domestic violence homicides are up, and Desiato says many shootings are retaliation for previous crimes.
Is this an ongoing thread? Is this something that we can somehow get ahead of and be proactive, whether through the means of law enforcement or through some of our partners?
Some residents and communities like Sherman Park are skeptical law enforcement can stem the violence. When about a dozen gunshots rang out one October afternoon, Patricia Norman and her daughter barely flinched, even though the shots sounded close to their quiet tree-lined street and they were on their porch.
To me, I don't get scared. I mean, if I feel like it's real close, I know what to, if I'm sitting out here, I know what to run my butt in the house.
Norman moved back to Milwaukee about 2 years ago and loves the city, but sometimes she feels hopeless.
Because if they can't get the guns out these kids' hands, then ain't nothing they can do. Because it's not going to stop. I don't see where it's going to stop. And I don't see what nobody can do about it.
A few days after the Oshkosh woman was murdered, a Milwaukee County judge told the 13-year-old the nature of his charges, including first-degree reckless homicide, could not be more serious. The boy told the court he understood, and he wanted to call his mom. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday with our returning guest, Dory Greenspan, who's now out with her 14th cookbook, Baking with Dory, celebrating 30 years of helping us in the kitchen. And the recipes are now up on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. I was able to try out a few last night, and I couldn't help myself because they were just that easy. I'm looking forward to hearing some simple, sweet, and salty recipes from you, too, after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret this afternoon, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.